Hi everyone, we are just checking in quickly before we introduce you to our last episode for season one to provide you with a little bit of context about the episode coming up and bid you farewell for what has been a wonderful first season of Monuments, Museums and Mojitos.
You might find that the sound quality varies a little bit as we did record this via Zoom or another internet provider. Interactive service, I think it was Zoom, and the sound quality was not the best. So apologies if it sounds a bit choppy.
Yeah, it was our first try, basically during lockdown. So I don't think that we sound very excited, but it's a good one.
Yeah, well, it's difficult because we have our like cocktail together and stuff. It's not quite the same mustering up the enthusiasm when we're not sat in the room together.
I think that's
cheersing
it
up. But yeah, I hope you still enjoy the episode nonetheless because it is an interesting topic. And let's get into it.
Enjoy, everyone.
Hello guys, welcome to the new episode of Monuments, Museums and Mojitos. My colleagues told me that I should sound more excited when presenting this topic, although what we're going to present is not really exciting for many nations and cultural institutions. We are gonna speak about the British Museum, one of the most globally recognized institutions about culture and heritage, a museum that symbolizes colonialism, and which contains heritage and artifacts which are widely disputed, which cause diplomatic problems between countries, and a museum which identity could drastically change within the next few decades.
Yeah, so treasure chest or treasure atrocity? Let's chit-chat about that. But to get us through, we are drinking a hard and fast cocktail, the Mai Tai, which, you know, is probably the strongest cocktail you can get on a standard cocktail menu. White rum, dark rum. Ours is with lime and some fresh juice and mint, of course. But yeah, like I've seen it on the menu and it's got like white rum, dark rum, tequila, vodka.
Everything you could ever imagine, like literally in a cocktail.
Every spirit. Nevertheless, we've made it taste good.
Like the British Museum, no?
It's a concoction of everything, yeah. This is what we are drinking to help us get through this potentially sticky and tricky topic.
Yeah. And if you order it in a bar or something, it always comes in those very colonial-looking tiki cups. So they're nice and fun and related.
On theme, yeah.
Yeah. So as I said, guys, the British Museum is one of my probably top five favorite museums. I remember when I visited it in London some years ago, I was really fascinated by all the heritage you can see there and uncover. And I remember that I spent, I feel like 3 or 4 hours walking around the museum. Me coming from a small country and having a small country complex, I was searching for Bulgarian artifact in the British Museum. So it was really a fabulous experience. And to be honest with you, I visited it before getting engaged with heritage and having strong interest in culture and heritage management. However, reading more articles and different books, I understood that, well, it's kind of a problematic museum. My opinion slightly changed, but still remain fascinated by it. And every time I go to London, I try to visit the British Museum. So what's your opinion, guys, about that institution?
It's a tricky one, isn't it? Because museums like the British Museum and the British Museum itself were the kind of institutions that made me fall in love with heritage originally, like, you know, growing up and going on school trips, because obviously I'm from the UK, so it was very accessible to me. It would be visiting institutions like that that would mean that I could see this, you know, wealth of world artifacts. And I kind of took for granted, as most people from colonial countries do, that it was kind of normal for museums to have these great collections. And it was kind of an assumption, I guess, I had until I got older and I could understand the context, that I thought that world museums would kind of exist everywhere, or universally museums would exist in like multiple countries across the whole world, but actually they are very limited to a privileged few. And then obviously as time has gone on and I've studied this firsthand, my opinion has also changed. Although I'm not sure I'd like to see them dismantled completely, but I think there's definitely questions around consent that really need to be addressed. But we'll get into that further down the line.
And you, Nikki?
Look, the first thing that comes to mind for me is, why don't they have air conditioning? Surely they have a ton of money.
Why?
Because it's in the UK.
No, like, I was there in 2018.
We have a heat wave like once every 10 years.
In July, and it was hot. And I went there actually every day for like a week. So I'm a fan. But there, it was so hot. Like, I just don't understand why they can't afford to put aircon on.
Because we don't need it in the UK. Like 70% of all time in the UK,
it was so hot. Like
below 20 degrees, so
it was so hot. It was exciting. It was really exciting. But I guess I went there because I had studied certain contents that are held in the museum for years. So for me, it was like seeing a celebrity, you know. I had read and I had seen so many pictures of the Rosetta Stone and, you know, written essays on it. And I was just in absolute awe when I saw it. Same with the Parthenon marbles and other artifacts, Ramses, Egyptian stuff, like so much. So for me, you know, it was like after a longing of like wanting to see this stuff for so long.
Should we maybe uncover a bit the context behind the existence of the British Museum, how it came to be? Isanu, as a British person.
And you know I love to give the history lesson.
Yeah.
I mean, there's obviously a long and grand history behind the British Museum. But I think, Nikki, you have a bit of info about kind of colonial museums as a whole.
Yes. Yeah. I think it's interesting to understand kind of how colonial type museums came to be in existence, which is something I had never previously considered, but it makes a lot of sense pretty much. So Europeans, beginning with the Portuguese and Spanish, began to explore the unknown world in search for trading partners, better routes and goods. This was fueled by the Enlightenment thinking of the time where, you know, Europe underwent major intellectual and social transformation. And suddenly the wisdom from the ancient world, which had grown and been the norm, was being challenged by the role of reason. So scholars, you know, suddenly moved away from the ancient world and through texts, pictures and such, and wanted to actually go out themselves and see things firsthand. So once they were like in the books, now they're going out and checking things out for themselves. For example, here I'm going to talk about Captain James Cook again. So he was an explorer, and with him and a team of naturalists, artists and scholars on the ship Endeavour went out with their primary objective to transit the planet, to see what was around. Kind of try and map space and try to actually calculate the size of the solar system so they could help the British Navy.
I mean, that's a pretty lofty goal.
Yeah, it was big moves. And, you know, just quietly on a similar scale, his second motive was to search for the unknown great southern continent to the south and west, Terra Australia Incognita. That's Australia. He did that.
Yeah, because they'd already figured out, hadn't they, that Australia must exist because of the kind of weight of the continents in the northern hemisphere.
Something so, like that, yeah.
So they knew that there must be a continent there. It was just a question of finding it.
Yeah, so that's what he set out to do. And, you know, there were a bunch of other dudes on the ship. They were the first Europeans to reach Australia in Stingray Bay, now known as Botany Bay. And basically they just collected things from the natural world. It's estimated that that voyage specifically acquired over 30,000 plant specimens and other things. For example, Joseph Banks, who was an English botanist at the time and was on the boat, saw a kangaroo for the first time and was just like absolutely confused and was like, and described it as a large greyhound or moose. And it was very soft and fluffy. And what's this thing in its pouch? So this is like what they were doing. This is the type of thing that was happening. They were going, exploring, taking and keeping, because they kept mostly what they took, and it was mostly held in private collections at the time because there was no museum prior to this. Yeah, FYA, they took native people on board as well, which the lease back didn't really turn out well for the native person.
Taking native people on board, do you mean slavery?
Actually, no. They took people as kind of helpers, as for surveyors of their land. So there's this one guy on Cook's second voyage who took a young man called Mai from the island of Hauchi near Tahiti, who came to be called Omai, the first Pacific Islander to visit Europe. And, you know, he came to London and he became an absolute sensation. He even met the king and queen and was held in a high social class. But then a few years later, when it was decided that he should be returned, when Cook went on his third voyage, you know, he suddenly went back to his society where he wasn't being treated like a king and could not integrate. And it's thought he like just died a few years later.
Sad story.
Yeah. So this was the vibe. This was the vibe. Over 250 years later, objects from Cook's voyages are dispersed throughout most of museums in Europe, as well as North America, Australia, and New Zealand. But yeah, British Museum for sure.
Yeah, as you were saying, the evidence that was collected was kind of treated as oddities, as wonders, as curiosities. It was like, look at the wonders of the world. And you could establish your status in society by how much of this you owned. Like if you had cabinets of curiosity at home with great collections from around the world, it would kind of show that you were, you know, more worldly, wealthy person. And that's kind of how the idea of the collection and the museum grew. So the British Museum starts with Sir Hans Sloane's personal collection. He was a physicist and a president of the Royal Society. And when he died, he bequeathed the collection, which had more than 80,000 natural and artificial rarities and a vast library of over 40,000 books and manuscripts and 32,000 coins and medals. So it was a huge collection even then. And it just grew from there. The British Museum itself was founded in 1753 and opened in 1759 to the public. It was free, it was national, it was a public museum, though for its early years, it remained restricted to the privileged few until around the 1830s, when it finally actually did open up to everyone. Because, you kind of have to have a lottery for tickets to get in before that. And so it was who you knew as to whether you could get the tickets.
And you had to have clean shoes.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
That was a requirement. Yeah, they were very literally. Picky.
What do you mean clean shoes?
I don't know. It was just a requirement. Once you had been like confirmed a place, one of the things was clean shoes, please. Wow. Clean shoes.
But I guess even then they were thinking about the care of the collection in a way, like much as we kind of think that that's quite funny.
They're so good at that.
It shows that they were thinking about it even back then. It is worth pointing out that Sir Hans Sloane's wealth and his fortune came from sugar plantations. So he was very much an imperial figure, a colonialist. Yeah, he wasn't just some kind of wealthy benefactor who had this money from, I don't know, from his family hereditary. It was definitely made from sugar plantation profits in the Americas.
Which is slavery, if you didn't know.
Yeah.
99.99% slavery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Sloane's collection became the foundation of both the British Museum, the Natural History Museum, and the British Library, which is housed alongside the British Museum. So three of the kind of biggest, most well-known museums in the UK today started their lives as part of his collection. He was kind of a founding father of museums, I guess, but also a colonialist and a slave owner. So yeah, now the British Museum has 6 million annual visitors. It has 8 million objects and it covers 2 million years of human history.
8 million objects?
8 million. Yeah.
That's a lot.
Only about 10% of which is actually on display at any time, because the rest is all kept in storage, which is another issue. Sorry, guys, one second. I just need to let the cat in.
So Isan is back. Isan's cat,
the cat is now under my chair.
Yeah, so we can continue recording. So Isan said that the British Museum has literally 8 million objects. So guys, my question is, which are your favorite?
My favorite objects are objects that shouldn't be in there.
For example?
Oh, there are many, but I think if I have to pick one, it's the Rosetta Stone.
So what's the story with the Rosetta Stone?
It was found in 1798 by Napoleon of France when he conquered Egypt. And basically, because it's got three different texts on it, it allowed historians for the first time to translate Egyptian hieroglyphics and subsequently crack the code for countless other Egyptian texts. So this single rock, if you want to say, if you want to call it, allowed for us today and back then to understand Egyptian hieroglyphics, because it had ancient Greek on it and Demotic and ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics. And because those other texts were already understood, they were able to directly translate the Egyptian hieroglyphics. And then a few years later, the British took it as a trophy and brought it to the British Museum. And they also vandalized it with the words captured in Egypt by the British Army, which is actually still visible today. So if you go and see it, it's got a bit of vandalism on it.
Lovely.
Yeah, way to go, British Army.
Anything else? Yes, and you?
I mean, mine are also probably slightly problematic. I think I was always fascinated by the mummies growing up. So it would have to be probably the sarcophagus in coffins that had all the kind of gold inlay and that kind of thing, because they were just so impressive to look at. And I'd read about them in books since I was, you know, 6 years old or whatever. But now there are definitely calls from Egypt to return these to their motherland. And yeah, so they're still not really the best examples of consensual ownership. Yeah. But
are they also actual mummies, like the bodies are on display?
There are actually 6,000 human remains in storage in the British Museum. So their display and study provide one of the most direct and insightful sources of information on past lives, human biology, different cultural approaches to death, burial practices, and belief systems, including ideas about afterlife. The question is now, though, is surely we've actually learned these lessons already. So why are we still holding on to those dead bodies?
Why?
Like, why do we retain them?
I don't know.
They've already been researched. And like, when you think that how much effort the ancient Egyptians went to with their burial practices, their religion and the way that they buried their dead was so important to them. And now we just kind of disregard that because we disregard their religion.
For these cultures, the afterlife was their everything.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Why they lived. To, yeah, you know, have the best preparation they could for the world that came after life. And we just rip them up and put them in a fridge in the basement of a museum.
Okay.
And these human remains are from all around the world. So there's Egyptian ones and there's Native American ones. There's Australian First Nations, like from everywhere.
Communities that still practice these traditions and these burial practices and this spirituality, particularly in Indigenous Australia, they want them back. It's their people. It's their ancestors.
We can start talking about one of the main issues with the British Museum, their collection of heritage, which doesn't belong there, and which is controversial and which many countries and nations demand to be returned. What's your opinion about it? What's the place of universal museums in contemporary society, basically? We have started speaking about decolonization, right? We have several examples from the Netherlands where several museums started approaching that topic and started changing the narratives in their museums and institutions. In fact, the Netherlands, I think, is the country which is leading the way in that.
Along with Germany. Germany have done some big improvements in the last few months, actually.
Yeah.
They've made some big announcements specifically to do with the Benin bronzes, which we'll go on to later.
But we should mention that they're leaning in terms of maybe cultural policies and decolonization. Maybe Britain is a bit more advanced in educational policies in decolonization, but we should say that cultural institutions like the British Museum are kind of struggling in adapting to this new trend.
Yeah. And I think it is very difficult for these institutions, because even other museums who are working quite hard to address their colonial pasts, like the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford, they're working really hard on this at the moment and doing a lot of community engagement and reaching out to First Nations people or the original owners of the objects so that they can get opinions on how they should be displayed. But they're also facing a lot of backlash because some key components of their collection, such as a collection of shrunken heads, which they had, which were kind of fan favourites, shall we say, they've removed them from display altogether. And so then we ask the question, well, if they're removed from display, what is the museum doing with those? Are they going to repatriate them to their original cultural context? Or are they just keeping them in storage and therefore not explaining them? Would it be better to keep them on display and give them a better educational context? And those are questions that they're having to face at the moment. But that's a museum that's actually facing up to this, whereas the British Museum has a much more blanket policy of just, these are our things and we keep them and we decide what goes on display.
Yeah.
But they're not alone. The universal museums of the world have mostly very similar attitudes towards this.
Yeah.
And in 2004, there were, I think it was 14, maybe more, of the museums who signed the Declaration on the Importance and Value of Universal Museums. Only 2004, so not that long ago.
Right.
And that included museums in the USA, Germany, France, Italy, Spain, the Netherlands, and Russia. And the British Museum didn't sign it themselves, but they did issue a press release the very next day to say that they fully supported it, basically.
But they didn't sign it.
No, they didn't actually sign it, which I thought was quite interesting, but maybe they just weren't. They didn't have a representative there.
Well, they just didn't have time. They were very busy. Yeah.
I think the big difference between the British Museum and other Universal Museums is that there are some extreme cases in the British Museum.
Yeah, that's true.
Which are very popular in media and politics. The marbles are a great example of that.
Yeah, the Parthenon / Elgin /
It doesn't seem like anything's going to happen.
What do you think should be the approach? Why nothing is happening? Why
give them back?
Yeah, but why is this not happening? What's the reason for that?
I don't know. They obviously want to keep them. There's the argument of like, oh, if we give one thing back, then we have to give everything back, which I actually disagree with. I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think everything needs to be contextualized and every item in there needs to be approached in its context and the context of today. But the Parthenon marbles, you don't have to look far. The Greeks want them back. Am I right? Normal British society doesn't give a shit.
Boris Johnson is very pro keep the marbles, but
keep them marbles.
But there's not a lot of like patriotic feeling either way, I don't think. Because I think the British people can recognize that if it's something that the Greek nation feels so strongly about, that they want them back. And, you know, although the museum obviously has, 6 million annual visitors, but there are how many million people living in the UK? Go to the British Museum and see them every year. So they don't care.
It's poorly curated. I don't know if you've been, but like literally the walls are the exact same color as the marbles. So they just bleed into the walls. Like there's no contrast.
Like beige.
Yeah.
It's just another room in the massive complex that is the British Museum. They've got other Greek stuff. One room that means so much to the Greeks that would literally, I don't think it would make a major difference if they left the British Museum.
Like we said, they had 8 million objects. So I'm sure they find something else to fill the space.
Yeah, look, I can bang on about this, but I don't want to bore everyone. But if I don't know, we want the context of how they were taken, and I can tell that.
Go into it now.
Yeah.
Okay. So basically, like, the argument, I think, is, or one of the biggest arguments is that, oh, we didn't steal them from the Greeks, they were taken. So in 1801, the Ottoman Empire was ruled over by Sultan Selim III, and Athens itself was controlled by the civil governor and the Dizda, military commandant of the fortified citadel, aided by the lieutenant, so-and-so, so-on, who cares? The Muslim and Christian communities, however, were administered separately, the former by the Qadi, judge, and the Mufti, religious leader, and the latter by archons, who supervised tax collection, and the archbishop, who was responsible for education and other social matters, as well as the continuation of the Orthodox faith. Lord Elian's team of artists arrived in Athens. A dude called Logotheti took charge of the team of artists and was responsible not only for their expenses, but also for seeing that they had access to the monument that they needed to study. Access to most of these was relatively easy, except for the case of the Acropolis. The reason being that on the Acropolis, firstly, it was a military fortress with consequent military sensitivities. Second, the ruins of the Parthenon contained a small mosque. Third, the woman folk of the Dizda and his lieutenant, together with those of a few janissaries, lived there. So basically, there's an argument saying that the the Ottomans let us in. And basically, they argue that they were given a firman, basically an official letter, and this was something that was used within the Ottoman court and by foreign diplomats and travelers for a variety of different things. But the problem is, we don't have this firman. This firman doesn't exist, and it's never been found. The only version of it that we have is an Italian translation, which was kept by Reverend Philip Hunt, Lord Elian's chaplain, and it was acquired by the British Museum in 2006. And oh boy, it's on display. It's on display in the room where the Parthenon marbles are, which basically is trying to claim their legitimacy. But it's not an original. It is a translation, and there are errors in this translation, or there are issues with this translation that discredit its legitimacy, which I won't bore your ears off with here, but it's kind of not good enough.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's the argument that, no, the Greeks say, we didn't give it to you. The Ottomans did. It's not us. It's them. We didn't give them to you. We want them back. They're ours. Please give them back. We never gave them to you.
Yeah, but what about the marbles having more exposure in the British Museum and London as, let's say, the capital of the world? Maybe marbles in Greek culture have more exposure in that museum. In the end, the British Museum argues that it's an institution that represents world heritage.
I think there are two things not wrong with that, but that could fix that. We're not. The Greeks, myself included, I'm a strong advocate, and we're not asking for every speck of ancient Greek culture to be repatriated. You can have pottery, you can have statues, you can have other structures, but these marbles are important to us. They are important to the Greeks. They are part of a structure that is still standing and that still has its own museum that has places waiting for them. They haven't replaced marbles that are in the British Museum with copies. They have left them purposely blank to show that there is something missing, and we are planning on getting this back.
It doesn't need to be those marbles.
Yeah.
Could be anything else. And the Greek government have been very open to exchanging other objects or loaning the marbles.
In your opinion, what needs to be changed in the strategy of the Greek government?
The Greek government or the British government?
The Greek government needs to convince the British one that the marble should be repatriated. So what needs to be the change in strategy and discourse coming from the Greek government, in your opinion? So far, we want them back. It's not working.
Yeah. What has been happening is not working. A legal avenue has not been taken, and I believe it has not been taken for a very purposeful reason, and it's that it's not strong. I hate to say that, but it's not strong. So what I think needs to happen is, let's move away from trying to figure out what happened, why they're there. This needs to be about morality. It's no mystery where they came from. It's no mystery that they're from the Parthenon. We know, everyone knows they belong there and they're from there. And we as people need to ask ourselves and maybe ask others, what's the right thing to do? Do we give them back to the people?
The Egyptians have been very successful with their repatriation campaigns, because they basically said, if you don't return the stuff that we've asked you for, you don't get to do any more excavations in Egypt. Greece haven't done that kind of thing. Maybe it's EU legislation that wouldn't allow it, but maybe they just need to get a bit harder, a bit more hard-nosed.
Just as we know, the British Museum is filled with lots and lots of stuff, so there's quite a lot to get through. So we've decided to split this one up into two to not bore your ears off with one long, massive episode, but rather break it up in digestible bites.